This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Okay, welcome back, friends, foes, and assorted others. This is the People Speak Radio Show. This is Rick Chicago from Albuquerque, New Mexico. You also know me as Earthplay. The People Speak Radio program normally airs every Tuesday night, 6 to 7 p.m., 9 to 10 Eastern on BBS Radio Network. You can participate in the show at the bottom of the half hour by calling toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. That's 1-888-38-429-5471, and it is free, I believe. Tonight, we have a very special guest with us. We have Professor Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. Boy, that is a mouthful, Guy. Welcome.
Yeah,
to our
I'm sorry about that. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm sorry about the long names of the departments there. I picked the two departments that had the longest names and decided to go with them.
There you go. And tonight's show could cause some anxiety for some people. So if you suffer from mental illness and or depression, my best advice is to slap some water on your face, because tonight we have some pretty serious topics. We're going to be talking about the sixth global extinction. Is that right, Guy? A global extinction?
Sixth mass extinction is what it's usually called.
Okay.
A mass extinction event is one in which at least 50% of the species on the planet go extinct in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, that's not very good. Now, I've been reading week after week, month after month, massive animal die-offs on the West Coast due to Fukushima, but isn't it true that this has been going on for a lot longer than even Fukushima?
Yes, it absolutely has. It's difficult to tie it down to a single event. I'm sure that Fukushima is a significant contributor, but I suspect the warming ocean, the decline in phytoplankton, which is the base of the marine food web, and also an acidified ocean. All those three characteristics are probably contributing to the die-offs as well.
So now the acidification, that's directly man-caused? Is that the chemicals? And it's not just sediment running off of the continental shelves, is it?
No, it's not. It's a result of putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And when we put that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and it gets soaked up by the oceans, which is the first place most of the carbon dioxide molecules go, is into the ocean, and that tends to acidify the ocean. It makes it into carbonic acid, acidifies it more than it already is.
And that right now is affecting the coral reefs around the world. I've heard that as much as 80% of the Australian coral reef, Great Barrier Reef, could be dead already.
That's right. That's right. It's a tragedy, a travesty what's going on there. More than 90% of the northern portion of the reef is already bleached and dead. We're in the midst of the third global ocean bleaching event since 1998, and also the third one in history. So if you're looking for an indication of abrupt climate change, that's a great place to look, because we've had three of these in the last less than 20 years, and three of them in human history so far.
And these are considered to be mass events, mortality events?
Yeah, the bleaching events are ones that are global. That's what we're talking about. So they're not just found on the Great Barrier Reef. They're not just found in the Pacific. They're not just found in the Atlantic. They're all over the ocean at this point. And we're in the midst of the third of those that are worldwide.
So now, can these coral reefs recover? What is that process? The new growth has to occur. Will it occur on top of the dead growth?
It can, and it all depends upon the availability of habitat, which really means temperature that is appropriate for coral formation, and therefore the ability of the corals to come in and get established again. But, you know, this is the third hit in less than 20 years, and no species can take that for an extended period of time. We have acidified the ocean, we have warmed the ocean, we have in many cases already pushed many species past the limits at which they're capable of surviving. That's an indication that we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction. It is pushing species beyond the habitats that they are accustomed to or that they are capable of surviving in.
Okay, so the biggest problem here right now would be the water temperature. Is that a correct presumption?
Yeah, the water temperature is huge. Acidification also is also a big deal for the coral bleaching, as it is for all the other species in the ocean. You know, each species on the planet is adapted over evolutionary time to a really quite narrow range of environmental conditions. And when we alter the conditions so that they no longer fit, no longer suit the species in question, then that species just can't survive there. And so in this case, it's undoubtedly a combination of the right temperature of ocean and also the right level of acidity or an alkaline nature in the ocean. So there has to be the right amount of salt, the right amount of heating, the right amount of everything, really. And we're talking about narrow conditions over which almost every species on the planet has evolved.
And we're crossing over that boundary, kind of playing on. Not only are we crossing it, we're like playing skip across, playing on and going beyond the line for the systems that maintain the Earth's environment.
And that's the key point here, and that one that most people don't understand. This is not about the ability of species to pick up and move around. It's not about the relative cleverness or adaptability of species. It's about habitat. If I were a realtor with an understanding of ecology, my catchphrase would be habitat, habitat, habitat. Because that's really a reflection of that location, location, location that realtors use to try to tempt people. And that's what we're talking about is habitat. Without habitat, no species survives. That includes ours.
So is that what's going on in our oceans right now? We have the elephant seals, sea lions, porpoises, whales, fish. They're migrating and the migrations are going wrong, or there's just no habitat for them to move to, or what exactly is going on with the marine life on our coastal shores?
You nailed it. It's all about habitat. There's no place for them to move. There's, again, a relatively narrow range of conditions. They have to have appropriate temperature. They have to have appropriate supply of food. And that's about it for the organisms that persist in marine environments. Well, the ocean temperature probably is survivable for the big species like sea lions and seals. That's probably not the big deal. The big deal is probably the food, and the food is being heavily influenced by acidification and temperature, and also undoubtedly by ionizing radiation from Fukushima.
No doubt, and even more radiation is coming in because the magnetic field strength is falling. Big holes are opening up in the ozone layer, allowing more of that cosmic and background radiation, plus all the radiation that we have released on the planet. Go ahead, Guy.
You're absolutely right, and again, that's something that many people do not understand. They think that we solved the ozone problem back in the 1980s by largely eliminating chlorofluorocarbons from our refrigerators and from our cars. But in fact, all we did was cause the large ozone hole over the Antarctic to eventually stop growing in size. But ozone holes or thin areas are developing all throughout the atmosphere on a pretty regular basis. I'm reminded of this almost every time I'm on a speaking tour and I come across somebody who is an avid gardener who otherwise spends a lot of time outdoors. And among the first things they tell me is, it seems so much hotter than it used to be, just within the last year or two. And that's because it is hotter on your skin than it used to be, because there is not the protective ozone in the atmosphere to help filter the sunlight that's coming in.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if the success of my gardens this year may be a result of Fukushima and radioactive fallouts, wherever the sources might be. I have had so many anomalies in my gardens, like the century yucca that only blossoms every I have blossoms. I have multi-headed flower blossoms. Same thing with the rose plants. And the English ivy has yellow spots in them now. Just a lot of weird things. Dandelions growing like, you know, 2 feet tall with huge poppy heads and the little fuzz seed blossoms that open up. And I'm not used to seeing these types of things in my garden.
That's right. And now they're popping up in pretty much everybody's garden. And I see them with the local folks here in southern New Mexico. I see them just about every time I'm on the road. And it's the gardeners, the people who spend outdoors on a very regular basis, that are the first ones to notice that we're in the midst of profound changes in habitat for other species that doubtless at some point will include us.
Yeah, and I was just recently on the edge of the Vallis Caldera, and we used to do a lot of hunting up there where you would have to cut your way through the forest. There was so much grass and wildflower and shrubbery growing up under the forest. We were up there this last fall. There was no grass, no flowers, no shrubbery, and only about the top 4 or 5 feet of the trees were alive. There were no squirrels, no insects, no bugs. No birds, nothing at 10,500 feet in the wilderness, Guy.
This doesn't sound good to me.
No, it does not. It's really startling when you're used to that kind of habitat and environment and you've lived that way your entire life to go up there and for there to be such a stark difference in the matter of just a number of short years.
Right, and it has been a relatively short period of time, and this is what typifies this event. We are in the midst of abrupt climate change. It's a completely different phenomenon than most of us are familiar with, because we didn't hear about this in An Inconvenient Truth, for example.
Right, right. Let's see, so now not only do we have mass migrations. This is not only going on in the oceans now, is it, Guy? I've heard of these large mammal herd die-offs of the caribou in Alaska, in Russia, in Kyrgyzstan, or one of the stands over there. It's just not limited to marine life. It's getting into larger mammals. I've even heard of horses dying on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah. It's certainly not restricted to marine environments. At this point, if you want to look for mass movements, you can restrict that search to people. You know, and people use terms like migration, but really, with respect to places like Syria and the southern island states in the South Pacific, these are not migrations. Migration indicates that the organism will be moving back where it came from.
Right.
And in this case, we're talking about a refugee crisis. We're talking about, for example, 5 of the Solomon Islands going underwater within the last few years. And they're not coming back. And so those people, they don't have habitat anymore. So that's why they're moving elsewhere. They're not going on a migration or a vacation, and they'll be back next winter. Nothing like that is happening.
Well, now we're seeing these extinctions in the oceans, in the forests, in the wildlands, across the planet. Why aren't we seeing it in the human species, or are we?
We are seeing it in the human species. Actually, there's a really nicely done video clip that appeared initially in November 2014 on an HBO program called The Newsroom. And in 4 minutes, the character, who is a climate scientist, responds to questions from the news anchor. And he, in response to the question, what would all this look like, as if we're going to expect something dramatic in the future, he responds, well, there are going to be mass migrations, and instead, as I indicated, this is a refugee crisis, it's not migrations, and it's already underway. Right. He says there will be food and water shortages. Well, those are already underway as well. And he goes on and on with this list of dire consequences for the future, and here we are a year and a half later, and all of those are playing out in very, very large numbers. Already 5 million people a year at least die as a result of climate change. And abrupt climate change is really just getting started.
And now a lot of that could be being masked under this insidious disease they call cancer, and how widespread it seems to be across our nation right now, as though it was an average thing like catching an average cold.
You're absolutely right. There are so many. For one thing, it's difficult in many cases to pin the cause of death on climate change. So, we're talking about changes in habitat. We're talking about reductions in food, reductions in water supply. Already 4 billion people out of 7.4 billion on the planet, 4 billion don't have access to daily potable water supplies. So where do you draw the line at that being a result of climate change and other interacting factors? It's difficult to distinguish.
Yeah. And how much of this is contributed to the natural world as opposed to being self-inflicted, shooting ourselves in the foot? Look at our water. Lead in our water on a daily basis, and in our food, GMOs. Now they have this new thing called Codex Alimentarius, where they want to control your vitamins and supplements and the uptake into your body. It seems to me like most of this is self-inflicted.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you want to look for any number of ways that we can reduce our own health or actually kill ourselves, and there must be thousands of ways we can do that, and it seems to me that we're pursuing each of them with as much vigor as we possibly can.
It's absolutely no sense whatsoever, Guy, but it seems to be the reality that we live in.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing, really.
Now, I was watching one of your videos earlier, and it just stunned me that you said in a video that anybody can go over to your website over there on YouTube under Nature Bats Last, Guy McPherson's website, where you attribute a lot of this to the political environment, the media environment being controlled by a select small number of people, and they're just leading us into oblivion.
Yes, that's exactly right. There have, in the 1970s, which is when I was a kid, and I suspect you were too, somewhere in that neighborhood, there were hundreds of media organizations, and even though there were only three television news stations in this country that were of any note, there were many sources for news. Now, six corporations are responsible for more than 90% of the media, so it's relatively easy to control the overall tenor of the messages we receive by the thousands every day. All you have to do is get those six corporations to listen to the same outlet. In this case, it's almost always the AP or the UPI, and then put that identical information out to the masses. And that's where almost all of us receive all the information that we receive each day.
Yeah, have you ever heard of a guy called Mark Dice going out and talking to average American people out on the street and asking them about our government, our environment, things of that nature?
No, but it sounds pretty terrifying.
It's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. Like asking people who the vice president is. Nobody has a clue. That's regardless. Now, you're a professor of evolutionary biology. So let me ask you, what good are these vaccines? Are we now living longer? They say, oh, we've never lived longer. You know, we're living to be 70, 80, 90 years old, and our health is better. Our lifestyle is better. We live longer. We have vaccines. We have medicines. But what are they actually doing to the human condition scientifically?
That's a good question, and I'm not really well-versed in the latest information about vaccines. The point behind vaccines, for example, the flu vaccine, is that the flu bug changes every year. And so every year we are exposed to a new organism that the vaccine is designed to ward off. I've no doubt that some vaccines are better than others. In fact, I believe it was last year during the flu season, the vaccine was largely ineffective, that as many people, a statistically insignificant increase in viability was experienced by the people who got the vaccine as opposed to who did not get the vaccine. And I've no doubt that with respect to other factors, like childhood diseases, the vaccines are losing their potency over time. And for example, we have only recently identified the first superbug in the United States that is now resistant to all of our known antibiotics. So, you know, you can't play God with the universe and expect that to work out well when you're one of up to a trillion species on the planet and you don't have nearly as much power as you would think because you're so dependent upon all the other species surrounding all of us. So, you know, this is, in my mind anyway, the vaccination issue is part of a medical issue that we think we have considerable control over, that maybe we really aren't so much in control as we thought we were.
So the evolutionary and continuation of the human race medically and scientifically is what is kind of iffy?
Well,
can they do that? I mean, they believe that they can do that. But what's the reality? We have people that are dying from pharmaceuticals. We're dying from people having people that die from the vaccines.
Yeah, you know, we can't outwit nature.
At the end, are we actually living much longer?
Well, the longevity of individuals reached an apex and has certainly flattened off within the last couple of decades, in fact. So, of course, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and then with the widespread use of antibiotics in the early 1900s, of course, individuals live longer than they otherwise had. But it appears that 100 years of messing with Mother Nature on a really, really serious level is catching up to us. The author of a paper in Science Advances from about a year ago, a guy named Gerardo Caballos, says in an interview, life would take many millions of years to recover, and our species itself would likely disappear early on. He's referring to the sixth mass extinction, which is already underway. And so, you know, we are one species among millions, perhaps up to a trillion on the planet. We have for my entire life, probably for at least the last 100 years, we've acted like we are the most important species. There is this myth of human supremacy that we don't actually depend upon the other species for our own lives, but that's a myth. We are part of this fragile web of myriad species on the planet. And there's no escape from that, much as we like to convince ourselves otherwise.
Yeah, well, grinding up the planet's natural resources, the forests and everything, is not sustainable. So we may run out of food long before our science figures out how to keep us alive for 100, 200 years.
Oh, absolutely. There is that's one of the reasons that millions of people are dying already is because of lack of food. So I expect that to continue and accelerate in the years ahead.
Well, and Monsanto's really isn't helping the situation, are they? Monsanto's to feed the world? Seems to me like they've strangulated the world's food market, made it worse.
Yeah, and if you didn't know better, you'd think that was all about money.
Yeah, it's their leaders the path to oblivion here.
That's right.
What other questions did I have for you? These are related to the sea ice and the methane and cathrate trigger, as you call it, and positive feedback loops. Just how many of these boundaries do you suppose that we've already crossed?
Well, enough that we have locked in our own extinction due to lack of habitat in the not very distant future. And I used to put a date on this. I no longer do that because when I put a date on it, everybody in my audience would assume that they would die at midnight the day before that.
2012.
So if I said, for example, if I said, that I suspect there won't be a human being on the planet in 2029, then everybody listening to the conversation would go, oh, well, it's all good until midnight, December 31st, 2028, and then I'm going to die. Well, that's really not what an extinction looks like, and that tends to shift the focus away from the important parts of my message and instead on a date, which I understand why people want to focus on that. It would be a lot handier, I think, if instead of having a birthday, we were given a death day at our birth, and then we'd know what we're up against and how long we have.
So let's give our audience a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about with these methane hydrates and cathrates that are being released and how drastically they could affect us all globally, not within years, but, could descend on us within days. Is that right, Guy?
Yeah, that's correct. There are two what are called fast feedbacks that are of particular importance on my list of 65 self-reinforcing feedback loops. One of those is the clathrates or hydrates that are chemical cages around methane. And they're first described, and most notably they occur in the relatively shallow subsea beneath the Arctic Ocean. And so here we have many thousands of tons of these methane molecules surrounded by these clathrates. And when they're released, they go directly into the water column or directly into the atmosphere. And climate scientist Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa concludes that we could experience at least a 5 degree Celsius global average temperature rise in a decade or two. And he made that prediction in late November 2014. And already, as one example of abrupt climate change, it took 265 years, the first 265 years of the Industrial Revolution, up until September 2015, to warm the planet 1 degree Celsius, or about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. So from the baseline of about 13.5 degrees Celsius, or 56 degrees Fahrenheit, it took 265 years to warm the planet. Overall planetary temperature went up about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. That took 265 years. It took the next four months for the global average temperature to rise another 0.57 degrees Celsius, or nearly 1 degree Fahrenheit. So when we talk about abrupt climate change, that's what we're talking about, is a relatively slow, linear progress in global average temperature rise for a long time, and then boom, an exponential increase in global average temperature.
Yeah, and it was really odd that you mentioned Paul Beckwith, because I got his video today over his sea ice volume report, and he's now calling for a blue ocean event. And I thought to myself, a blue ocean event? You know, aren't all the oceans supposed to be blue and all the time? And what kind of an event is he talking about here? And he shows all of his graphs and his models about the sea ice coverage and the thickness and where we are today. I think his video was, what, not even a couple of days old or hours old. And we're already in pretty bad shape this year, Guy.
Yes, we absolutely are. There is, we're already at least 2 weeks ahead of the 2012 melt season. And 2012 was when the Arctic experienced the lowest ice cover ever measured, and probably ever experienced since our genus Homo has been on the planet. The last time there was a blue ocean event in the Arctic, that there was no ice in the Arctic Ocean or no measurable ice in the Arctic Ocean, was probably about 3.5 million years ago. Our genus has been here for 2.8 million years. So well before our genus, much less our species, arose on the planet, there was a blue ocean event in the Arctic. And it seems that consistent with the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College's analysis from several years ago, it seems that we're headed for an ice-free Arctic Ocean in 2016. And that's what they predicted several years ago. They said 2016 plus or minus 3 years. I would say we dodged a bullet each of the last 3 years, and that we're headed for an ice-free Arctic this year. It certainly seems like that prediction from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College is right on the mark.
Yeah, and you can see these images, graphs, and statistics for yourself if you know where to look. I'm not even sure where to point people to the Paul Beckwith videos that are coming out. I suppose you could just Google sea ice or blue ocean event. Guy, we're at the bottom of the half hour. You're listening to the People Speak radio program. This is Rick Chicago in Albuquerque. We're talking to Guy McPherson, and we have to pause for our one and only break. Are you still with me there, Don?
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
No, I think that's my favorite song. Welcome back. You're listening to the People Speak radio show. This is Rick Chicago, a.k.a. Earthplay. And yes, indeed, we are at Pal Talk Live right now at the People Speak radio show. And today we're talking with Professor Guy McPherson. And you're in Arizona, aren't you, Guy?
I'm in southern New Mexico. My appointment is with the University of Arizona. But I left active service about seven years ago. Yeah. And now I live in a homestead in southern rural New Mexico.
That's great. I love New Mexico. And I'll be heading out of here first thing in the morning for Strawberry, Arizona, and Sedona. I can't wait to see it. Now, before we went to the break, we were talking about the sea ice volume and the Blue Ocean event and Paul Beckwith. And you actually have his website, don't you?
Yeah. You can track Paul's work at paulbeckwith.net. Beckwith is B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H. And probably the most reliable source for ice cover in the Arctic is the National Snow and Ice Data Center at nsidc.org. And they've been measuring ice cover since 1979 when the first satellite was put up over the Arctic Ocean.
Oh, okay. I have this Danish meteorological survey site. Is what I look at. Now, you have a lot of websites yourself there. You have GuyMcPherson.com. You have Nature Bats Last on YouTube. And here's the one that intrigues me because I've been getting very emotional watching some of your stuff lately. OnlyLoveRemains.org. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the primary website for tracking information by and about me is probably the GuyMcPherson.com website. The OnlyLoveRemains.org website describes a workshop that I have developed with a colleague, and it's specifically intended for people who have come to grips with the notion of near-term human extinction as a result of climate change, and they find it to be a relatively isolating experience. And so this is an opportunity to create a venue that will generate a conversation about that topic and help people deal with the science as well as the more emotional side that comes up in light of that science.
Okay. Now, we have audience participation from our chat room, and you can call in live in the few minutes we have remaining with Guy at 1-888-429-5471. And we already have a caller on the line, Don. Who do we have there?
Mike in California.
Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Professor McPherson. You know.
Hi, Mike.
Been looking forward to this show for a long time because it seems like the mass media, the mainstream media, doesn't even talk about this. I mean, they'll talk about global warming, etc., but they don't talk about what it means to the human race as much, that we currently are in a mass extinction crisis. And all the science fiction films we've all seen come to mind, especially Matrix, where the machines were actually trying to save humans from themselves. I think that's what we need now. We need some kind of, I think it's out of control. I think we're a species out of control. And, you know, there's no accountability. You know, I don't see anything other than divine intervention or some kind of extraterrestrial influence as really changing things around. What do you say?
I couldn't agree more. I think that We're in need of a miracle, or maybe a handful of miracles. In the absence of those miracles, which we've yet to document a miracle in the history of the planet, as nearly as I can tell, in the absence of such a miracle, I can't imagine a situation that has humans on the planet 100 years from now, 50 years from now, probably even much sooner than that. So, no, I don't see this thing turning around.
Professor McPherson, one other thing. When I speak about this, and I do speak about it, I try and talk to other people about it. They get very depressed, and they're saying, you know, I'm going to plant an organic garden and recycle things. That's my contribution. I say, I'm sorry, but you know, that's great. But you know, I mean, how do you deal with that? How do you I mean, what has been the typical reaction when you speak to large audiences about this in your class or wherever?
Well, I don't teach in classrooms anymore. So it's mostly the general public, although I do relatively frequently on a speaking tour have the ability to talk to individual classrooms, but I don't have classes of my own. And that's unfortunate because when I have classes of my own, it allows me to establish a relationship with the individual students that persists over 15 or 16 weeks over the course of an entire semester. So that allows us to develop a trusting relationship and have a more in-depth conversation than we can have in the span of a 2 or 3 hour event. But certainly, there's a wide range of emotions that are expressed when I speak and in the wake of my speaking. Some people obviously are devastated. They knew that climate change was anthropogenic, but they had no idea that there was even a subject such as abrupt climate change. So hearing about abrupt climate change and that it's an actual threat to our own species, obviously our favorite species.
Well, I wanted to just have one more question, and that is, considering how dire it is, what are your religious or non-religious beliefs, and do you think that will play any, you know, I mean, if ever there was a time for a divinity to make itself known, it would be now, I would think.
Is there any salvation for us?
Yeah, I don't, I frequently hear about God or gods or aliens rescuing us, and frequently I'll be sitting next to somebody on an airplane who will claim that God wouldn't let that happen to us, and my response is, do you think God is going to be pretty impressed with what we've done with the place so far? I mean, are we really worthy of that miracle, given that we continue to grind the planet into dust? And if you're of the Christian Bible part, we haven't really done a fine job of stewarding the earth, have we? We haven't really taken care of the other species on the planet. So I'm a scientist, and when I'm acting in the scientific realm, as I hope I do most of the time, I don't rely upon paranormal phenomena or supernatural phenomena for a way out of this.
Guy, we have another question from Steve in Australia. Do you see the changing galactic weather might be affecting our planetary system at all? Have any knowledge of that?
I sometimes hear about this galactic weather change, but I don't see much evidence for it. So in the absence of that evidence, which doesn't seem to come from the refereed journal literature, for example, I don't really know how to respond to those kinds of comments and questions.
You know Dane Wigington, don't you?
Yes, I do.
We've met a time or two. Yeah, I'd love to meet the guy face to face. We have correspondence. And do you agree with his guesstimation here that we have already crashed through the guardrail and are going over the cliff, and it's too late to hit the brakes, it's too late to turn back? And our society and our public, as we go over this cliff to our demise, are squabbling over what station the radio is on.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty reasonable and fair assessment, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of scary to me, you know. So what do you think about that, the geoengineering, how much that's contributing to speed up the problems that we're already having and these boundaries that we're crossing?
Yeah, I rely on evidence from fairly conservative sources, including the refereed journal literature. As nearly as I can tell, there was one article in the refereed journal literature on the topic of geoengineering, and it was withdrawn shortly after it was published. I think that geoengineering in the form that Dane Wigington speaks about it is unsupported by evidence. I've no doubt that we have been geoengineering the planet since the advent of agriculture. When we turn soil over, we release carbon dioxide and a small amount of methane into the atmosphere. with animal agriculture, we're definitely increasing the amount of methane that goes into the atmosphere. So we have been geoengineering the planet. We continue to geoengineer the planet every time we flip a switch or turn the key on the internal combustion engine. But I don't see the kind of they that is out there trying to purposely modify the weather through solar radiation management, for example, that kind of particulate management that would be used to modify the weather.
Yeah, well, I'm not very happy about this situation at all in any detail. We have another caller on the line. Don, go ahead and put him through. I think we had another
call.
Hello. Do you have a question?
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good. Do you have a question for Professor Guy McPherson?
Yes, I do. You know, linking this up politically, we hear Donald Trump. He wants to burn every fossil fuel there is on Earth. When asked what the greatest threat to humanity was, his response was not global warming, but nuclear weaponry, which is, you know, definitely a threat. But my question is, when you look at the support that Donald Trump is getting, winning the nomination in a landslide on the GOP side, why is the electorate not seemingly more in tune with the catastrophic peril we face with global warming and willing to vote for somebody who's so anti-climate, global warming rhetoric?
Well, it'd be difficult for me to come up with a more misinformed and willfully ignorant society than characterizes the United States today. We have almost all of our media coming from those very few sources I mentioned earlier. We have people who are purposely willfully ignorant about almost every topic of any importance, people who are unwilling to look at the evidence because the evidence suggests that we are fouling the air and dirtying the water and poisoning every aspect of the atmosphere and driving 150 to 200 species to extinction every day. People don't want to look at that. It's a train wreck that's been underway for a long time, and nobody wants to look at the train wreck, especially if there's bodies all over the place. So I suspect Trump is actually playing to an audience that doesn't want to know what's going on in the world. And so Trump provides the perfect distraction to look away from what is actually going on in the world. So I mean,
I'm
more a fan of reality myself, but I'm not terribly surprised that other people are not fans of reality, because reality in this case looks pretty awful. Whether we're talking about climate change or the sixth mass extinction or any of a number of aspects that derive from this set of living arrangements, whether it's disparity in income, disparity in wealth, or how we're washing away the soil into the oceans. You know, there's not a heck of a lot of good news out there. And so if I weren't addicted to reality myself, I'd be studiously looking the other way.
I agree with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Now, evolutionary biology, that's us. Natural resources and ecology. So where do we stand, Professor? I mean, we cannot sustain this for much longer, a decade. I've heard of scientists saying that we don't even have a decade left in us.
Yeah. And it wouldn't surprise me if we ran out of habitat in a much shorter period of time than 10 years. That said, I've no doubt that some people will persist even in the absence of habitat for a few more years. So just because we managed to kill almost every other species on the planet doesn't mean some people won't have stored food and stored water or the ability to tap into a water supply for a few years longer. But we are in the process of driving many, many, many other species to extinction every day. We are eliminating habitat for our own species. And you can't sustain the unsustainable indefinitely, and that's what we're trying to do at this point, is sustain the unsustainable. What we're doing cannot be sustained, and therefore it won't be sustained. At some point in the not-too-distant future, I suspect our habitat will simply go away, and then the survivors in the Great American Dust Bowl and the inability to extract potable water, the inability to grow food, the searing temperatures, the extreme cold events, and so on, the survivors will persist for a few more years off various ways of keeping their bodies warm enough and cool enough and well-fed enough. But I don't think we have long. And I'd be stunned, absolutely stunned, if there's habitat for our species on this planet in another decade.
Well, what do you say to the people that say that this is nothing more than fear porn? These are not important things. You know, there are birds in the trees outside. My trees are doing fine. I mean, how do you talk to people about this and shut down people that just say, oh, it's they marginalize you, fear porn, next subject, please?
Yeah, that's tough, because as a relatively privileged white man, of course, I have this enormous ego that makes me think I have to be right all the time. So just walking away has never been something I've been particularly good at. You have to bear in mind that I'm the last person you should expect to be presenting this message. I left active service at the university 7 years ago to establish a homestead, and I established a partnership. My wife and I established a partnership on this homestead, and the whole goal was to persist beyond the lack of habitat for our species on the planet by having an enormous orchard and a well-insulated passive solar heated home and multiple water sources and so on. And so I it's not as if I want this to happen. It's not as if I view this as any sort of rosy outcome. When I made this move, I was thinking about linear climate change, not abrupt climate change. And now, despite this enormous investment in ego and money, it appears that I'm going to end up just like everybody else, dead, and sooner than expected. So I'm not a fan. I don't think there's any way around this, and I'm open to any rational perspectives that point to a way out of the predicament we're embroiled within.
And we wouldn't live very long under a dome, a biohabitat or something like that.
No, in fact, if nothing else, Biosphere 2 was an excellent example in just how far money and fossil energy can go. There were 8 Biospherians living for 2 years in Biosphere 2, just outside of Tucson, Arizona, where I lived for more than 20 years. And each one of those Biospherians lost a lot of weight in the 2 years, and they were constantly opening the hatch and bringing more food in and bringing more materials in to keep those people alive for a little bit longer.
Well, Guy, we have about 15 seconds left. Is there anything that you would like to say to our audience?
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and let's do it again sometime. In terms of the audience, I welcome their participation at the blog, guymcpherson.com, and let's keep the conversation going and let's spread the word that things are happening faster than expected.
Thank you, Guy, and let's have you back again. Appreciate your time tonight, sir.
It's great. I appreciate it as well. Thanks very much.
Good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.